And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, December 28th, 2016. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Lisa Cron. Lisa is the author of Wired for Story, The Writer's Guide to Using Brain Science to Hook Readers from the Very First Sentence. Lisa's worked in publishing at Norton as an agent at the Angela Rinaldi Literary Agency, as a producer on shows for Showtime and Court TV, and as a story consultant for Warner Brothers and the William Morris Agency. Since 2006, she's been an instructor in the UCLA Extension Writers Program and is on the faculty of the School of Visual Arts MFA program in visual narrative in New York City. And she's back. She was here for her first book, Wired for Story, and she's back today to talk about her new book, Story Genius, How to Use Brain Science to Go Beyond Outlining and Write a Riveting Novel Before You Waste 3 years Writing 327 Pages That Go Nowhere, published by 10 Speed Press. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Barbara. It's so great to be here.
Love that title. It says everything.
Long, I know. But it sort of gets the point across.
Well, let's begin by hearing you talk a little bit about Story Genius and how the book came about.
Okay, well, the way that it came about, and it's interesting. I think everybody needs to work with someone when you're writing, and I think really from the very first stages. So I actually, believe it or not, have a writing coach myself for nonfiction who actually developed her first novel with her most recent novel within the pages of Story Genius. Her name is Jenny Nash, and when I wrote Wired for Story, which was sort of the culmination of decades of story analysis and working with writers and trying to figure out, okay, what works and what doesn't, and when I'm pulled out, why? Because that was my job as a story analyst in publishing and for the movies and for TV. And what I discovered was that what pulled me out and what made a story not work had almost nothing to do with what writers are taught. How to write and what matters. It was kind of shocking. And so at that point, I started to write Wired for Story, and luckily for me at that point, neuroscience was really, had made so many exponential discoveries that kind of what I thought of as, okay, this is how I see it became, oh my gosh, this is how we process information. This really is what's happening and is what we come for and is what we're wired to respond to in every story we hear. So I wrote Wired for Story, and kind of long way of coming back that when that book came out in 2012, Jenny, who had, worked with me on that book, said, okay, you cannot sit down and go, this is great, it's out there, and I don't have to think about anything. How are you going to teach it? How are you going to take this theory, which did have a lot of prescriptive things, but it was still, here's what to look for, here's sort of how to do it, here are the things that matter, here's why, here's the questions to ask yourself. But it wasn't a step-by-step guide. It wasn't a, okay, you've either got an idea for a novel, and now how, or a memoir, or really any kind of story, because the truth is story, and what we're wired to expect is the same thing, regardless the format, regardless the genre. But it was, okay, how are you going to teach that? How could someone take that and develop a novel from scratch? Or if they've already written a novel, where is the diagnostic they can do to really figure out if it's working, and if not, why not? And I have to say that having worked, as an agent and in publishing and in TV for like more decades than I truly want to admit to being alive, most agents and editors will say that most of the manuscripts they've read, if you ask them what's it about, they'd say, it's about 300 pages. I have no idea. It's just a bunch of things that happen. And so really, because that is what tanks most novels, most, whether you're looking to be published traditionally or whether you're looking to, to self-publish, the reason that books either are not picked up by agents or editors, or if you self-publish it, only your family and friends tend to buy it, and whether they actually read it or not, you never actually know, is because most novels are just a bunch of things that happen. And of those 97, I think 96% is a statistic that I found of novels that are rejected. I was talking to my agent about it, and we were going, oh, that's way too low a number. It's actually more like 98-99% of novels are rejected, and that's why, because they're just a bunch of things that happen. And so I wanted to change that, and that's what Story Genius became. It was how to teach it, how to go, where to start, what to look for, what it is that, you know, that wires us. And a lot of it, Barbara, became, and this is something that I say, and it's and I know it's incendiary, I think writing is taught wrong everywhere, beginning in kindergarten, certainly once you get into post-secondary education. So a lot of what I teach, when it's either in a workshop format or in the book, is undoing what writers have been taught matters, because it doesn't, because that's not what grabs people, and busting the myths of what, and I'm doing air quotes now, you can't see me, but what talent is, and what it means to actually write, and what you need to know in order to actually write a novel, and I mean know about the story that you're writing, not know in terms of how to write a beautiful sentence or, you know, or anything on that level. So that's a long way of answering your question, but, and I think I answered it, but you can let me know.
Well, you know, I still have a lot of questions, and one of them is early on in Story Genius, you talk about how plotting is almost right, but not quite there, because the focus is on the wrong thing. It's on the external plot rather than the internal story. So then why is it so important to know specifically about the internal change your main character undergoes?
Okay, and let me just say that when I say it's almost there, but it's still 100% wrong. If you just start with plotting, you will end up with a book that's nothing but a bunch of things that happen. But you do have to have some idea, obviously, of where you're going, but why you're going there really starts with what a story is actually about. And if I could just say that really, you know, as quickly as I possibly can, the reason that the internal is not only more important, but it is what we're wired to come for. Because let's talk for one second about what a story actually is, because it's different than what a lot of people think, because we're used to looking at finished stories. So, you know, when you write a story, when you read a story, you start, I mean, by definition, page one, you read through to page 327, and it's easy to think that that's how you write a story, and it's 100% not, because what a story actually is, and let me say it once relatively slowly. I know I talk fast, so when I say slowly, it's like, you know, it's still fast, I know. And then let me just break it down for one sec. A story is about how what happens affects someone in pursuit of a deceptively difficult goal, and how that person changes internally as a result, and then can deal with that problem. So let's break that down. It's about how what happens, and what happens is just the surface of the story. It is not what the story is about. And yes, the what happens is the plot. And the story, if I leave you with nothing else, is that your story is not about the plot. That's why if it was up to me, and here comes one of those really super incendiary, both literally and figuratively, you know, statements, I would burn every copy of The Hero's Journey and every story structure book out there. Because, first of all, story structure is a misnomer when you look at those books. It's plot structure. And your story is not about the plot. That is merely what happens within the story. So it's about how what happens, that's the plot, affects someone. That's your protagonist. And your protagonist is your reader's avatar within the story. I often think of stories as sort of a Vulcan mind meld, you know, between the protagonist and you, the reader, and that the mind of your protagonist is your novel's, you know, for lack of a better term, command center. And everything that's going to happen over there in the plot, no matter how, and I'm doing air quotes again, objectively dramatic it seems, is going to get its meaning and emotional weight from one thing and one thing only, and that is how it's affecting your protagonist internally in the moment as they struggle with what to do, because in every scene they're going to have to make a tough decision. So, and when we say everything in the plot gets its meaning and emotional weight based on how it affects your protagonist, you don't mean that objectively, like, you know, your protagonist, like, hates it when it's cold, so it's snowing outside, so they decide not to go where they were going to go. It's not objectively. It's how it affects your protagonist in pursuit of a deceptively difficult goal, which you can call your story problem, your plot problem. And really, it is kind of two-sided. There's the external thing thereafter, and then there's that internal problem as well. And that's why all protagonists are struggling in one way or another, because story is about change. Story is about how we're forced to change, because let's face it, most of us don't make even those big changes that we promise ourselves that we're going to do, right? It's time for New Year's resolutions, so we're probably making a lot of those promises right now, but we don't tend to do it unless something forces us to, some external thing that we can't avoid. As they said in The Godfather, you know, make him an offer he can't refuse. So it's how what happens at the plot affects someone, that's a protagonist, in pursuit of a deceptively difficult goal. That is your story problem, what they've got to go after. And how that person, meaning your protagonist, changes internally as a result. And that internal change is what your reader is wired to resonate with. That's what pulls us in. That is what your story is about. Your story is not about what happens in the plot. Your story is about how your plot affects your protagonist. The story's internal. It's not external. It is about an internal change that your plot is constructed to force your protagonist to make. And if you're thinking, well, wait a minute, like what internal change? Change from what to what? Why? That brings us to the answer to your question, Barbara, which is every protagonist enters the story with two things already fully formed: a long-standing internal desire that they have had for a very long time, and what I call a misbelief, something that has kept them from getting it. Again, misbeliefs come into life, and when I work with writers, it's really funny, or in writing workshops, and they'll go, oh my gosh, I was looking for my protagonist misbelief, and I found my own, because we all have these defining misbeliefs, which is a way that we think the world works, because life taught us at one point, usually early in life, that was how the world works. That's just wrong. And that misbelief has guided our life up until the point, now here comes the plot, where the plot's constructed to force the protagonist to go after that thing that they've really long wanted. But in order to do it, they have to overcome their misbelief, which they don't see as a misbelief at all, but as a very savvy piece of inside intel they've picked up about life. And so that's where your story gets its meaning. That's what's pulling us in, not the objective external things that happen, but internally, subjectively, what that's forcing your protagonist to struggle with as they make the decisions that they make throughout the story, because they're forced to go after one thing. Because one last thing, and I know I can go on and on and on, so you can tell me to shut up at any point. It will not offend me. But just one last thing before you do, is that a story is about one problem, one external problem that grows, escalates, and complicates from the first page until the last, and usually it started way before the first page. And that external problem forces the protagonist to deal with one internal struggle that grows, escalates, and complicates. It's one thing all the way through. And the only way to know what that is to develop the story long before you get to the plot. Because, and I promise you, this time I promise it's the last thing, because all stories begin en medias res, which is Latin for in the middle of the thing. And if you look at, you can't see me, but I'm like holding my arm up, and I'm going on one side, I'm so bad with right and left, but on the, I guess it's the left side, if that's page one, right? And if you're starting there, that is the beginning of the second half of your story. The second half of what? All stories begin long before you get to page one, because you need to know what that change is, what it means to your protagonist. And so I will stop now, because I will go on for hours if I don't. But that is what you need to develop first. And I promise this time, I do promise this. And that is to bust one of those myths. That is backstory. And backstory gets a bad rap. Backstory is the most fun, story-specific backstory, not just, you know, birth to death bio, what happened to your protagonist from now until from birth till the story starts, because who cares? I mean, when people do that, it tends to be, you know, a mile long and an inch deep, because it's just a bunch of things that happen, and you develop things that don't really have anything to do with your story. Story-specifically, you develop your backstory in terms of this misbelief and this desire, and that is the most fundamental layer of your story. As Faulkner so brilliantly said, the past isn't dead. It isn't even past. In fact, and now talking about neuroscience a bit, the past is how we make sense of the present. The past is, think about it in your own life. The past is your decoder ring for what things mean right now in the present, and it's how you make decisions. That's what needs to be developed first. And interestingly, when writers do that, the plot tends to spring from that. It's really interesting to see how, and again, you're asking story-specific questions. It's not general stuff ever. General is the, you know, enemy of story. Story's in the specific. It's really interesting to see how the plot not only develops, but takes on depth and meaning and resonance. And you never have to worry about that thing that you worry about if you're, and I know this is another thing where I get in big trouble, but I don't care because I feel like if I don't say this, it's like sending someone to a really important job interview with spinach in their teeth, and you don't want to say it because it will make them feel bad. I think as bad as plotting is, pantsing is the worst thing you can ever do because you get people starting to write forward with no idea who anyone is, no idea where they're going. And I'm sure as writers, you know, often you get that feeling like you're in the middle of a big, giant field and you don't know what happens next. You don't know why. You don't know where you're going. You don't know. And you think, God, you know what I really need right now? A nap. And you put it down, and then 6 months later you go, wait, what happened to that? Or you do the worst thing, the other thing that writers do is they'll go, I'll just write it really pretty. I'll throw in more metaphor. I'll make my language lovely. And that's how you end up with novels that are nothing but a bunch of things that happen.
Well, so, you know, I want to talk a little bit about backstory because that is an area that writers become really confused about.
Yes.
I think, you know, it's like we've been cautioned about using flashbacks. We've been cautioned about including backstory. And therefore, we can write, you know, long, long passages of dialogue without ever really knowing what the character, the protagonist, is thinking. So how do you know, as a writer, when you're using backstory or flashbacks that are necessary and when you're just, you know, throwing
giving
in stuff
giving a dreaded info dump.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's the reason, just very quickly, the reason that writers are often told, don't give us backstory, is because what it really means is don't do it poorly. And I had an experience, it's funny, I was working with a writer who, you know, I was asking him about this. He said, no, I never put in a flashback. My writing instructor said, never use flashbacks. And I went, God, that was like the time for me back in elementary school when, oh, no, wait a minute, that's a flashback. And I said to him, I said, well, I think what she really meant was don't do it poorly because so many writers, because they don't know what story is, and we'll talk about that in one sec, do it poorly. And the most the story goes on because I guested in a writer's class at UCLA. Often we'll guest in each other's classes, and I was telling that story, and I heard this throaty laugh behind me, and it was the instructor, and she said, that was me. I am the one who said that. And she said, no, but that's exactly what I meant. Don't do it poorly. There's one major writing, I'm using the air quotes here, guru out there who'll tell you don't put flashbacks in or anything in the first 70 pages, which is insane. Look, first I would say to you as writers, and then I'll explain why it's so important and how to do it. Go to almost any book that you like and start looking through and see how much of what you're reading is in, even if it's in the third person, is backstory, is flashback, is your character looking at something and thinking about something from the past and then going forward. Often books start with pages of that, but not, as you were just saying, Barbara, not as an info dump, because here's the scoop on backstory. Backstory, flashbacks, making sense of the past, is the lens through which we make sense of everything, so that when your character comes onto the page, whether it's on page one or deeply down, your protagonist, they're being forced to make a difficult decision. They're being forced to do something, to go through some change, to deal with something. You know, I often say that story is the difference between what we say out loud and what we're really thinking when we say it. That internal struggle, think about it in your own life, even when you're trying to order at Starbucks and you want the barista to like you. You know, I mean, we've all got that internal struggle. That's where backstory comes in. It comes in as we're trying to make sense of what should I do in the moment. That's why when it's done well in a story, you don't see it. Often you don't even feel like you've left the story present because your protagonist or POV character is going to the past to make sense of and to decide what they need to do right there in that moment, because they don't have a choice. So we're not talking about backstory as musing or, you know, a trip down memory lane or thinking, you know, about what they might do in the future if something should happen. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about it coming up in the moment as they've got to figure out what to do. They're being forced to make some decision, and they turn to the past to be able to decode the present to figure out what to do. And then often they'll think about whatever the decision they've got to make is or they're thinking of making, and they'll run it into the future. If I do this, will I get what I want? I'm saying it super heavy-handedly, obviously. And then they come back and they make whatever the decision is. But that's how it's done. And the interesting thing is, because, I mean, here's, again, a small neuroscience thing, but the first job of a good story is to anesthetize the part of your brain that knows it is a story. And that's not a metaphor. That's fact. When you're lost in a story, same areas of your brain light up that would light up if you're doing what the protagonist is doing. I mean, it really is. You know, stories are the world's first virtual reality, minus that, you know, super geeky visor. And if you've seen any of those, I just saw over Christmas one of those, like Google, you know, day, whatever it is, visors. They're very geeky, is all I have to say. And watching people have them on, it's so funny because they're looking around and nothing's happening. And it's more funny to watch, I think, than to have one on. But story is the world's first virtual reality. You really are there. And so the last thing you can do or want to do when you're in that state is figure out how the writer has created the sense of reality that you are walking around in. So if you can pull yourself out of it just a little bit, you'll start to see these layers. You'll start to see the, oh, I see, yes, this is a memory from the past. Because sometimes it's a full-fledged flashback, you know, where we stop and we're in a scene from the past. It's got dialogue and, you know, it's just a full-fledged flashback. Sometimes, very often, it's just a snippet of memory that goes through someone's head as they're making sense of what's happening in the moment.
You know, can you use these principles in Story Genius? Can you use them if you're writing a memoir?
Oh, absolutely. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's again, as I said earlier, story, regardless the format, regardless the genre. And memoir has to be written as well as a novel, because we're pulled in. It is the exact same thing. The reason memoir can be hard sometimes is because story is about how somebody makes a hard change. And those misbeliefs that guide us are, for lack of a better term, and there's so many terms I wish I could like redefine, and often because they're pejorative. Like people will talk about a fatal flaw. I would never use that term. In Wire for Story, I think I mentioned at one point, now I would erase all of it. Because fatal flaw, it sounds so, like, judgy. It sounds so judgmental. It sounds so finger-waggy, like you're almost morally making a mistake that you're doing on purpose. Really, it is a misbelief, and with memoirs, it's exactly that. You come in and you've learned something. But in order to come in and learn something, it means you didn't know it to begin with. And the hard part about memoir is allowing yourself to be vulnerable enough to be seen as someone who didn't really know, who needed to learn whatever it was, and then life teaches you. But absolutely, I think it almost helps, the way that it helps memoirists as much or slightly differently than the novelists, because novelists can make up, you know, we can make up anything we want. It's like totally, oh, well, that didn't happen. Well, wait, I'm going to set it on Mars, and that will make it much better. And obviously, as a memoirist, you can't do that. But it really helps you to focus in on the, what story am I actually telling here? Because often when people write memoirs, some big, you know, exciting thing has happened to them, and people go, oh, you should write about it. That's a great story. Mm-hmm. You should write about it. And what it really is sort of a big, giant anecdote or a big thing that happened, and it's amazing because it happened to that person. When we read for one reason and one reason only, and that is we come to every story with one question and one question only, hardwired into our cognitive unconscious. We don't think this consciously, but it's, what am I going to learn here that's going to help me make it through the night? What mm-hmm. am I going to learn here? What inside intel are you giving me into human nature so that I can better navigate my own life? I can understand myself better. I can accept myself more. I can understand the people in my lives better. You know, we don't come to story to escape reality. We come to story to navigate reality. And the reason stories feel good is so we'll pay attention, so we'll learn these lessons that help us better, you know, survive in the world. And so that's what we come to memoir for, too. So it means really being willing to be both vulnerable to the world, and it also means being willing to be open enough to say things that people in your life, you know, you might worry about, how are they going to feel about it? And, you know, that's the other sort of tough thing when it comes to memoir, I think.
Well, we're going to take a really, really short break, give you time to take a sip of water, and we're going to be right back. So all of you out there, don't go away. We'll be right back with Lisa Cron and Story Genius.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you,
just a thought,
my love, my whole world.
Dorothy Moore, Misty Blue. You're back with Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we're with Lisa Cron today talking about her new book, Story Genius. And before I go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but they're our opinions and views. Let's bring her back on. Hey, Lisa.
Hey.
Okay, so here's a question.
Okay.
among my millions here. So I was talking with a writer friend yesterday, and she was saying that she thought at a certain point the novelist needs to let go and let the characters do their thing, and that you as a novelist are not in control at a certain point. So I'm curious what you think about this idea that characters will take over, or at least need to take over.
You know, here's the really interesting thing, Barbara. It depends on how you hear that. I mean, if you have really, really done the work and you know who the characters are, then to some degree, I think that, there's definitely truth to that, because I mean, it's sort of the difference between kind of making something up a whole cloth without delving deep. So you've got people doing things, but you don't really understand why they're doing it, because we don't come to story for what happens. We come for why. We want to know why that character is doing what they're doing, and why, think about it in your own life or anybody's life, the reason why we do things is never has anything to do with kind of what happened solely in the moment, but it comes from our deep internal reason as to why we're doing it, given our agenda. We all have lifelong agendas. A protagonist has an agenda from before they step onto page one, and that agenda drives their behavior from page one until page 1,000, you know, depending on how long it is. So the deeper that you've dug, the more, as they go forward, that can be so. See, my fear of something like that in general is that it makes it sound like that is just going to happen anyway. In other words, if you haven't done the work and you're writing forward, suddenly your characters are going to come to life and they're going to tell you this or that, and that's total BS. That could not be less true. That's how we end up with stories that are just a bunch of things that happen. So, but if you've done the work, if you really know who they are, you know where they've been, and I don't mean know it like in a sentence, like you could sum it up in a, you know, in a paragraph or two and now you know, but really know deeply. What I advocate writers doing is, in terms of finding these story-specific moments, meaning moments in their past that created who they were and the struggle they're going to have in the present, is writing that out in scene form. You know, as in as much depth as you would if you were thinking of it as this is going to be a scene in the novel, because very often it actually is. So once you've done that to some degree, yeah. But as kind of a rule of thumb that it happens no matter how you start writing a novel or what you do, I do not think that's true. I think that's a sort of general thing that if someone just hears that, they'd go, well, I could sit down and I'll just start writing forward and I'll just go from page one and now suddenly my character is going to become this person. And that could not be less true.
Well, you know, since reading Story Genius, and I went back to read Wired for Story mm-hmm. before our interview, because I find the two books in combination work so well together. And, you know, I used to believe in being a pantser, you know, mm-hmm. like just see what happens. I'm just going to go for it. That's fun. And I am so not that way anymore, because you waste a lot of time. And so, you know, I can, especially I think from screenwriting, you probably learn that, you know, having some sort of treatment or synopsis can really help you go forward. And you talk about novel blueprints, mm-hmm. and I wonder if that's sort of a similar thing.
Yes and no. In the sense that I don't think that you can ever, way easier, you know, in film. I mean, because the one thing that prose does, that no other form of storytelling can do, is prose takes us down to what things really mean and what takes us to that one place that I'm sure Mark Zuckerberg and his minions are working, you know, 24/7 to try to allow us to be able to do. Thank God they haven't yet, which is to really know what someone else is thinking, to really know what that process is. And in film, you can't, I mean, if you tried to do that, you'd have, like, you know, endless voiceover and no one would watch it because it would be terrible. In film, you do get that from expressions and from body language. Interestingly, this is just a very slight digression, then I'll hop back. Interestingly, though, and think about this, I was watching that, did you watch The Crown? It's, I think Netflix did it. It's about, Queen Elizabeth II and how she became queen. Anyway, and they had a couple of scenes toward the end, one with the John Lithgow, who's, like, so good. You know, he plays Churchill. And he conveys so much in the eighth episode. If you're watching it all, the eighth episode when they're talking about the painting in the pond. Just anyway. But the look on his face, or the look on the actress, I can't remember her name, who plays Elizabeth, the very last look of the last episode, conveys, I don't know how you would put it into words. And that's the point. If you were a writer and you thought, okay, I'm going to convey what's going through their head by really describing that body language, you could never do it. You'd go, yeah, okay, I don't get that. Well, like, what's the point? You can't, it doesn't translate to words that way. What story does is it takes us deep, deep, deep inside so we really feel, and feeling comes from how we're thinking about something, not I'm happy, I'm sad, or my body language, I'm tapping my feet. So that is really what the difference, again, between story and film, and why in film sometimes you can much more easily, you know, kind of have some sort of a treatment, which really, you know, is the story just without the dialogue. But with a novel, and in terms of blueprinting, it's not something that you can do from start to finish like an outline, because it's something that you build as you go forward. And what I advocate is really getting the story part, the first half first, and then starting through the first half first, and then figuring out, again, what is that overarching external problem that is going to, you know, both last from page one to page, say, 327, that's going to force the character in every scene to go through this internal struggle, which gets harder and harder and harder as it goes forward. And then we talk about coming, okay, what is that aha moment going to be at the end? Because the story is about how, you know, character changes internally. It's like that great, what is it, T.S. Eliot says, the end of our traveling will be to arrive at where mm-hmm. we started and to see the place for the very first time. Sorry, we were just, my daughter with her daughter was here over the holidays. They just left and we were watching The Little Mermaid. And it's like, oh my God, there's the end. That's exactly, we've immediately come back to that opening scene again, except it's, you know, happening again. And now everybody's seeing things differently, so something else is going to happen. But that's what story is about. When we say, what's it about? What is that internal third rail, which is what I like to call it, that internal struggle that gives the juice and the meaning to everything that's happening on the surface? So we go and we leap to, what is that aha moment going to be at the end? What are they going to learn? What is that? This is what the story is actually about. And so once you've figured that out, and that doesn't mean the last scene of the novel or the screenplay, because often that defining aha moment comes usually in the last 20%, but it can be the thing that the character realizes that allows them to do that, you know, thing that's so hard that they never thought they could even do half of it when the story began. Or it could be in the middle of whatever that really hard thing is, and suddenly they see it differently, and now that allows them to, you know, to make the change or to solve it or not, depending on the kind of movie it is. Or sometimes afterwards, you know, when the big thing has happened and now they're kind of lost, but they look back and they go, wait, no, and they see things differently. So that aha moment is really kind of what the story is about. Again, all stories make a point, and that comes back to why writing forward without knowing anything is such a bad idea. All stories make a point beginning on page one. If you don't know what that point is, how can you write a story that actually makes it? And the way it makes the point is with this aha moment. So once you've kind of got that and you know what this internal change can be, you can start blueprinting forward, but you're blueprinting and writing at the same time, is the point. You don't just go, okay, now I can figure all this out, because the blueprint is not simply, here's what's going to happen. This happens, and then that happens, and then that happens. It's how can I say it? It's got two layers to it. It has more layers than that, but two basic layers. One is the external, what happens, and then the more important layer is the internal layer as to why it matters to the protagonist, how they're trying to achieve their agenda. And in every single scene, the way that they're trying to achieve that agenda, how they see the world shifts and changes. They have a little aha in every single scene. So the blueprint takes that basic cause and effect trajectory and starts to play it out. But again, part of it is writing, because you can't really know it until you start also to write it, but it's written again from, you know, from the internal and external together. Mm. So it's a back and forth process.
Sure.
It's iterative. You're constantly diving all the way to the past, even as you're writing halfway through, even as you get to the end, well, wait, why would they do that? You might dive all the way back to when they were kids. Oh, it's this. Oh, it goes back and forth throughout, in revision also.
So, okay, so then, I mean, how much do you need to know about your antagonist in terms of going forward, right?
I think with all of it, I think because it is your protagonist's story. And again, the great thing about it is as you're developing, your protagonist is who you develop first. Every other character spins off of that person. I don't mean spins off like they have known them since childhood, but every other person is there to force that person to go through the change that you want them to go through, either to help them or hurt them or to do a little bit of both. The same thing is true in kind of what we're talking about in terms of developing your protagonist. You would do really this exact same thing for your antagonist. you know, why are they doing what they're doing? What is that defining misbelief? And to get to that misbelief, I talk about something called an origin scene, where you go back to the moment that misbelief took hold. Why are they doing what they're doing? Because antagonists who are just all bad are boring. You know, it's just like, how dull could that be? You always want the why, and you always want to give us a bit of empathy for the antagonist as well. Because, again, so much of what we do doesn't come from, well, because I'm a jerk and I feel like being mean and I, you know, I hate everybody and I just you know, enjoy inflicting pain for no reason other than to do that. Usually there's some defining moment that made that seem like, okay, that's the right thing to do and here's why. And that's what comes in an origin scene, which is the moment that belief took hold in that character. And that's usually, you know, a moment where they were going through something traumatic and just emotionally traumatic, not like, you know, being kidnapped or held at gunpoint. And that changes how they see things. So you do the same thing for the antagonist. But the thing to think of with any secondary character, whether it's, you know, their BFF, or even if you have, it feels like several, you know, kind of main characters, usually there is one what I call alpha protagonist, one person whose story it really is. You really want to develop that character in light of the role that they need to play within the novel that you're writing. Doesn't mean, the really interesting thing is, it doesn't mean that then you just have them do the things that the plot needs them to do, because then they become plot puppets. You develop them as completely as you would your protagonist, but always in mind of, okay, this is the role they need to play, this is the role they're going to play throughout the novel in terms of the protagonist's journey. And then given that, they become whole and complete characters also, you know, to the point where you could probably pluck them out and write, you know, that they could be the protagonist of their own novel.
Mm-hmm.
But you would develop it just as much, and you would be aware of it all the way through, because that's another big mistake that writers often make, is they don't realize that every single character has an overarching agenda from the minute they step onto the page. I mean, it started before. It's not like it started the second they stepped on. It's continuing from there. The same way, you know, in our own lives, I'd say all you guys out there listening, it's like, think about if tomorrow was the first, if your life was a novel and tomorrow was the first page of it, you wouldn't wake up the next, you know, tomorrow morning and have no idea what you're going to do, what's going to happen, what's going to happen. Everything, when you think about your tomorrow or, say, a year from now, you already have an idea of what you're going to do, right? You have the dreams of the things you think are going to happen during the year. You got your worries about whether or not you can make that happen, or you know where the trouble spots lay and the things you're afraid of. I mean, just think about the next year in your life. Same is true of every character who walks onto the page. And you probably have, as we all do, we have an agenda. I know what my agenda is for the next year. I'm sure you probably do, too. So does your protagonist. Mm-hmm. Where did your agenda come from? It came from your past. And so for every character, they step onto the page with that kind of defining agenda, a plan that they are trying to bring to fruition throughout the pages of your novel. If you know what that is, and you know it from page one, then in every scene that they're in, they're trying to bring that agenda in one way or another, further it a little bit more. So that helps. You can see how, by knowing this, you don't get to that place where I don't know what happens next, or I don't know where it's going, or I don't know, because you already know it. And then the goal is to keep track in each scene of what each character's agenda is and what they would be doing to fulfill that agenda. And that way you don't have them do something that, you know, something needs to happen in this particular scene, so they do something, but they don't have any motivation for it. They wouldn't really do it. It doesn't have to do with their agenda. In fact, often it fights with it. And then it will immediately pull the reader out. Mm. As far as the reader's concerned, that's how we're wired. We assume that characters in a novel operate psychologically the same way we do, basically, right? They've got an agenda. They've got what they want. They don't do things that go against their self-interest unless they have a compelling reason, and then we would need to know it. And, you know, and kind of last thing, you know, on this, and this probably is last thing, except it's, I don't know that it goes quite to your point, but just talking about secondary characters in this way, or any character, if you know what they expect in a scene, and you need to know that in any scene, what is a character going expecting, what do they want, what do they think is going to happen, what do they want to have happen, how does it not happen, so that you know that. But when you know those expectations, you need to get them onto the page. How do you get them onto the page? Internally, so you know what they're thinking as they go forward. And not just, oh, gee, I want to go in and I want to have an ice cream sundae, but where's the struggle? What are they worried about? Oh, my gosh, if I go and I eat it, they're going to see it. And she keeps fat-shaming me, so I don't know if I should. So that we know, well, we know they want the ice cream sundae, but now we know why it matters to them, because someone's going to fat-shame them. And that would, of course, be part of the whole overarching story. But you get those expectations onto the page. Again, same thing as we started talking about with backstory, with expectations, with how we're thinking, based on what it is that the character wants in the scene and what situation, because every scene there's going to be a hard, difficult choice that needs to be made. Difficult sometimes because it's bad, and difficult sometimes because it's good, because good change is just as hard as bad. Good change is often harder than bad change, because we don't expect good change to be hard, you know? But truth is, it's just as hard to leave home to get married as it is to leave home to get divorced. In fact, sometimes it's way better to leave home to get divorced, truth is.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, maybe last week, I don't remember. Where are we anyway?
I know.
Was in 2017.
On every level.
Oh, yeah, on every level. We talked a little bit about revision, and you were pretty adamant about how writers revise the wrong way.
Yes.
Talk about that and how someone might be able to use Story Genius to help revise.
Sure. I mean, the problem that most writers have, especially, I mean, this is where, you know, I take exception to, I love Anne Lamott. I do. I love Bird by Bird, but there's one thing she says that I completely disagree with. And it's when she talks about the shitty first draft. And absolutely true, as Hemingway says, all first drafts are shit. And she talks about it, and that is true. But it's in a different way than most people think. And she'll say, well, because of that, the first draft, think of it as the child's draft, she says, where you can romp, her word, not mine, you can romp all over and let it all out because, you know, it doesn't really matter. No one's going to see it anyway, so what difference does it make? And that couldn't be less true, because someone is going to see it, and that person is the most vital person of all, and that's you. And you're going to reread it and go, oh, my gosh, here's this big rompy thing. What do I do? And you're going to go, okay, wait, I know. It's a shitty first draft, so I'll go back and I'll just rewrite it. But the problem is that, and we don't do this on purpose, but tacitly, our first allegiance is to what we've already written, as opposed to the story we're trying to tell, especially if we're not 100% sure what that story actually is. So people will go back in, and their goal is to keep as much of what they've got, so they're looking for some sort of connective tissue, like there's no real cause and effect, there's no story, there's no internality, but they're going to find a connective tissue to weave these scenes together, and just kind of picture Frankenstein, except with three legs and six arms and two hearts, and it just sits there. And, you know, and the killer thing is writers then go, oh my gosh, you know, I guess I've put good time after bad, and I'm not going to be a writer. I'm going to take up something else for my creativity, like, you know, interpretive dance or something, which you don't want to do. Already way too many interpretive dancers in the world as it is. But the killer thing is most of those writers who give up at that point, what tanked their novel had very little to do with their ability to write and everything to do with their ability to tell a story. So when it comes to revision, and I do have to say again that 99% of novels that come in, and I don't just mean from people who are just trying to break in, I mean often from, you know, from accomplished novelists, need a page one rewrite. They just really do. Jenny, who developed her novel, and she has, you know, I think six books published, three novels, three memoirs, traditionally published. And she tells about a novel that she wrote, and she gave it to her agent, and her agent said, you know, when I got to the very last page, I suddenly knew what you were writing about. Go back and rewrite the novel so you can earn that last page. I mean, that's what happens. So what I say with Story Genius is, take the idea that you have, put it. Don't try to make it work in and of itself, because when that happens, when you try to reverse engineer something, it just makes it worse. Because if you've got things that aren't working to begin with, chances are you didn't develop what you needed to develop to begin with. So when I say use it as a diagnostic, take it through the steps that we have in Story Genius, which is, it's completely prescriptive. It's first you do this, then you do that, then you can ask this question, then you go forward, and see if it works. Sometimes, yeah, after that you can go back and go, oh my gosh, yeah, I can keep the shape in what I've got, and here's what I'm going to add in, and here's where the story logic is. Because what happens when you have one of those big, giant, rompy first drafts that don't go anywhere, you have no story logic. There's no way to figure out why anything matters, and so they're just, like I say, a bunch of things that happen. Once you've developed that story logic, which is what we're talking about, you know, what's it about? Who are these characters? What do they want? And I don't mean that in a, you know, in an actory sort of way, but I mean that layer and level of backstory is laced into every single page of the novel. And like I say, if you want proof, start looking for it in what you're reading. And if you look for it that way, you'll go, oh my gosh, yeah, I'm in this character's head. Oh my God, this isn't the writer telling me that they hate the red sweater that the other person's wearing. It's the way the character's thinking about it, and that's letting me know something about what happened in their past. Or, I mean, you'll find it on every page. Start looking for origin scenes. You'll see them in movies. You'll see them in, you know, Jenny and I do an online workshop of Story Genius, and writers will often go, we have a private Facebook page, they'll go, oh my God, I was just watching this movie, and, you know, or I just watched Arrival, and it totally follows this, or I just watched this show, and that's where the origin scene was, because that origin scene we talk about, you know, that happens, you know, way in the protagonist's past, or any character's past, often is right there in the, you know, in the novel, in the movie, as, okay, this is why, I get it now, I see it. So, I think it completely works as a diagnostic tool, because it shows you what's missing. And it allows you to develop the characters and get to know them better. Because people, I'll tell you a sad story. I teach a workshop. I think I'm doing it again in early April at UCLA Extension that goes over all of this. And I just taught it, I think it was in early September. And there was one woman who had been working on her novel for 4 years. And one of the things we do as we start to go backwards and develop these characters for, okay, who is your protagonist right before your story starts, and then we go further back to find their origin scene and what brought them there. And I said, okay, I just want you to write, like, a short thing of who your protagonist is before your story, before they have any idea the dark and stormy night you're about to subject them to. And she sat down to try to write it, and she went, oh my gosh, you know, I've never thought of this before, and doing this, I don't like my main character. She's really annoying. I wouldn't want to spend any time with her. It's like she'd never even thought about it before. And once she did, things started leaping out. And that's the point. This often is stuff that you haven't even thought of, not because there's something wrong with you as a writer, but because writing is taught wrong everywhere, and people don't teach this. They don't teach story. They teach writing, and writing is completely different from story. Writing, it would be like trying to teach how to make a cup of something with nothing to put the cup in. Story is content. Story is what it's about. Story is what moves us. Writing is simply the format within which you give it to somebody. In fact, the story is what makes the writing beautiful, not the other way around. But people will come in and they want to write a beautiful sentence, and that's how they never get past the first sentence, because it's got to be beautiful. But think about it. How could it be beautiful if you don't know what the story is, if you're not writing a story, if you don't have the content? It can't be. There's no such thing as the muse. You got to do the work. Writing's hard. You know, we live in a society that wants to make everything easy. You can do it in 5 minutes. NaNoWriMo, you know, write a novel. You can't write a novel unless you're a natural writer to begin with. You can't write a novel in 30 days. Right. All you can do is write 50,000 words. Will those words have meaning? Of course they will, in the dictionary. But beyond that, not really. So, yeah, this is the work that you do to create a novel. This is what story is. What I'm trying to teach is that we've deconstructed. This is what pulls us in. This is what a story is. This is what you need to know in order to write the story that you're writing, and this is part of the story as you develop it. It then, like I say, you know, leapfrogs into the story itself. Some people have a natural sense of story, which isn't talent, but it's just they can see all of these layers at once. Very few people have that ability. And when they do have it, it often goes missing. They can do it sometimes. That's why, you know, I'm sure you've had it where you're reading some novel that you love, and then you know how it hits a long, boring stretch where you think, okay, I love this writer, and I know it's going to go somewhere, so I'll go through that. That's because what we're talking about here went missing. There was no that third rail, that sticking with the story, one thing that grows, escalates, and complicates, one internality. That suddenly is gone, and now we're somewhere else, and we can't feel it anymore. Because all story is emotion-based. We're feeling what that character's feeling, not because you say they're happy or sad, but because we're watching how they interpret what's happening, and that's where emotion comes from.
Mm. Well, I wish we had another couple of hours.
No, I'm sorry. I've gone on and on again. I know I have a habit of doing
I have so many more questions, but we'll have to talk again. I just so appreciate you taking the time. It's been, I love these books. I find that your books really useful and helpful in my own work. And so
thank you
for writing them. And
All I want to do is help make the world a better place. And story is the most powerful communication tool on the planet. You can change the world with your story. Think about the world, the change you want to see in the world, and then write a story, because your protagonist, as your protagonist changes, so does your reader. As your protagonist comes out of the story seeing the world differently, so does your reader. Writers are the most powerful people on the planet.
Hmm. Well, thank you so
My
much,
pleasure.
Lisa. That was Lisa Cron. Her book is Story Genius. Her last book that she was on the show for was Wired for Story. And really, both of these books together are so useful if you're working on long form, especially. Although I'm sure it could work for shorter pieces, too, helping you to know who you're writing about, why you're writing about them. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. I've been Barbara DeMarco Barrett this whole time, I think. And the show, along with the others, will be podcasts within hopefully the next week on penonfire.com. You could do us a favor and do yourself a favor by going to iTunes and subscribing to Writers on Writing free of charge, of course. And when it's uploaded, you will get notification. If you can, find it under Writers on Writing, because there are other Writers on Writing, podcasts I've heard. You can look for my name, or you can look for Pen on Fire, and you'll find it. Somehow you'll come across. And if you subscribe and have time to leave a review for the show, that would be great. It'll help other listeners find the podcast. That's it. That's all for now. Happy New Year, and let's hope for the best in 2017.